Hello and welcome to another episode of City on a Hill, a podcast about what it means to be a citizen of heaven and a citizen of the United States. We want to encourage Christians to find their tribe in the church and their hope in the kingdom of God, rather than to seek both in the kingdom of man. So with that, let's get to it today.
Well, hello, my name is Eric Estep.
And I'm Scott Reevely.
And this is another episode of the City on a Hill podcast. Last week we had a mailbag session. We got a question out of the mailbag and talked about the American Revolution and some of the Christian responses to that. And that got us thinking. Scott was out for a little while and he pulled a book off the shelf and read a book about Christianity's influence on the American Revolution. So we're just going to jump back into the topic.
Well, yeah, I want to just say how interesting it was, actually. And the more I did with it, the more interesting it became. And the reason that I wanted to do more on the Revolution, and there's probably going to be more and more about American church history, is because I've come to realize we all come from someplace. Mm. And we're all the product of what has happened, you know, to us, what has happened to our parents, and we inherit stuff that we don't really recognize. And I think they did that in the Revolution too. I'm sure they did, just like we are doing that today. Mm-hmm. In fact, some of the things that we're experiencing today and the frustration that's caused us to want to start this podcast has come from the things we inherited mm-hmm. in the Revolution. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. And in fact, Mark Twain said that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes.
That's a good Twainism.
It is. And I think that we're having quite a bit of rhyming going on now in our world. And so wanted to start with just that as background, because I think it is very relevant to what we're experiencing today, rather than just mere history lesson. It's not a mere history lesson to me anyway.
Wanted to say it another way, we don't have new problems. We have the same problems we've always had. They've manifest themselves in different ways. And I think one of the tightest links we will likely always have, sitting as citizens in America, will be what was the posture of people in the American Revolution. And a lot of it, it's like rhymes or shared melody or we've heard this chorus before.
It's a refrain that keeps playing. And I mean, mm-hmm. a good movie will have the same, you know, refrain go through and through different songs or different scenes, and mm-hmm. that'll tie the thing together. The same thing is true with American church history, really. Mm-hmm. And so just up front, I'll tell you what I have been reading. I read Did America Have a Christian Founding by Mark David Hall. I read Religion and American Culture by George Marsden. And I'm almost finished with The God of Liberty by Thomas Kidd. And those three all spoke to the revolution and what essentially what effect Christianity had on the American rebellion against Britain. And so that's some of the research I've done. I haven't read it all since the last episode, but it has been really interesting. And I think the best way to organize the at least our conversation probably is to use what Thomas Kidd had. He said there are five ideas that proved pivotal for the revolution. And the interesting thing about these five pivotal ideas is that they were religious in nature, but were believed by Christian and non-Christian alike. Mm. And before I even started with the ideas, one of the things that I noticed, and I see it today, too, is that you can look at religion and politics almost like train tracks, that they travel together and they don't always intersect. In fact, they might want to stay separate. There's some ideas about that, mm-hmm. but they go in the same direction. And a lot of times, people who are believers and non-believers will be traveling in the same direction toward the same destination, and using the same basic framework, one being Christian, one being non-Christian, And that makes it very hard to distinguish really what is essential to Christianity and what is American, you might say. And should they be together and should they be apart? So,
do you think that train track idea is limited to, are you limiting that to the American context, or is that just human nature context? Are the way we think about politics and the way we think about religion has necessary entwining nature to it?
Well, again, we all come from someplace, and America came from a place where they were, where the train tracks were. It's like a monorail.
Right. Where hardly had, parallel, where, almost the same
where
line.
Where you had an established religion, and so their context and thinking about religion and the state was that those two go together, and boy, we don't want one that's going to believe differently than us, so what can we do about that? And they, in some respects, separated those two to make mm-hmm. them parallel. Mm-hmm. But I'm trying to think, if you go back or you go to a different place in the world, whether they're necessarily parallel. I think that is part of the heritage that we have from Europe, that they were together, established religions there, here, and Christian. Mm-hmm. And so the pilgrims come over here and they form the colonies and they decide on their, they're going to revolt. And what they have then is this water of Christianity that they're swimming in, and they only know that, really. Mm-hmm. That's only context. I mean, everything that came from Europe is a context, and so Enlightenment too. So they've got that, and that's all that they are. That's a context, so you can't really say outside of that context, are they parallel? They're parallel in that context, I would say.
Sure, and that's our context. And I can go back even further. I just finished up Cicero, The Laws, and he's going through, here are some ideal laws for putting a people together. And he had whole chunks of this book dedicated to religious laws. Mm-hmm. You need to have these religious practices in place because they are important for how a society is put together. So I agree with what you're saying in that parallel nature of politics and religion, and then the cultural nature of that too. But I also think we have tried to pull those two things apart in ways that's not actually natural. The way you desire to govern the city, the polis, the politics, is necessarily attached to the way you view God and the way God has put things together. And that's been a common connection all the way back as far as you've been philosophizing mm-hmm. about government. And I think we've kind of gone, no, these are separate. And my religion doesn't necessarily affect my politics, and my politics don't necessarily affect my religion. And without a good understanding of the reality that that's actually true, these things actually affect each other a lot, then we get into some really difficult, like, well, did religion affect this or that? Or of course it's all connected. It may be not connected the way you think it's connected, but the way I think about God necessarily influences the way I think about how the city ought to be put together.
Yeah, there's a lot more there than we can talk about.
Yeah, I'm just rabbit trailing right
Boy,
now.
Boy, you are you're off actually on something we do want to talk about it in the future. Mm-hmm. But we'll get there, Lord willing, someday. So, but yes, in America for sure, those things are traveling along parallel lines, and we see it in kids' first idea that is pivotal for the revolution. And that is the disestablishment of state churches. So as I mentioned, they came, the pilgrims came over from an established church, didn't want to reestablish it in the same way. That's kind of simplistic to say that, because for the most part, the states had state-established churches, or the mm-hmm. colonies had colony-established churches, and all of that kind of dissolved around the time of the revolution. That was part of the thrust of becoming independent, was to also disestablish the churches. But when that happened, the disestablishment of the churches was favored by the church, especially the dissenters. The dissenters were people who were not part. They were religious. They were Christian, but they weren't part of the established church. They dissented against the established church. they held out saying...
Being the Church of England at the time.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. We must not... well, the Church of England in England was.
Mm-hmm.
In the South, the Church of England, southern colonies, the Church of England was established. In the Congregational Church was established in some of the colonies in the North.
Mm-hmm.
So there was there's some variation there. And some variation was not just even a denomination, as we think of them today, but Protestantism. Or they had, it was established, there was a test for people who could hold office, and they had to believe in the Trinity in one colony. And in another colony, they had to hold to the authority of the scriptures or something. So there were various tests and various kinds of establishments among the states. But the interesting thing is this disestablishment of the states, what came from both ends, and it still does today. I'm a pastor. I want to keep a separation between the church and the state for the sake of the church.
Mm-hmm.
There are some people who believe maybe even the opposite of me, who want to keep a separation of church and state because they don't want the influence of the church on the state. And so we have the same goal in mind, but we have completely different belief systems underneath that goal. That's what I mean by parallel.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened. There was a pastor who was a strong advocate for the disestablishment of the churches. And he became an ally of Thomas Jefferson, who was not a Christian and was not necessarily a friend of the church, but he also wanted to disestablish the church. And so they worked on this together, one for Christian reasons, one for non-Christian reasons, and they had the same goal in mind. So that the more I think about that, the more interesting it becomes, because... That's, is it American like Thomas Jefferson, or is it Christian like Pastor Leland?
Mm.
And it's a little bit hard to discern what is going on with the motive even for that. So,
but did those two guys, I'm assuming that those were the ones that put together the no establishment of religion in the Virginian Constitution, and that language is what was used for the U.S. Constitution. Is that?
I think they both were working on Virginia. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then it was carried over and used as the main language for our
First Amendment.
We call the First Amendment. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And so the disestablishment of the churches was one of the more important things that they had. Religious ideas that united Christians and non-Christians alike against Britain. That's mm-hmm. the other thing. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of noise about Britain sending an Anglican bishop over to New England and establishing Anglicanism as the American religion. And people didn't want that. They didn't want their... What it means when it's established is that the state supports the church. Mm-hmm. And so that meant that tax dollars would go to the Anglican church. Mm-hmm. If you were Congregational, or if you were Baptist, or if you were Presbyterian, or if you were a Jew, or if you were anybody else, Catholic, your money would go to support the Anglican church. And so they really thought that was out of bounds. And that was one of the things that they... that made them excessively nervous about England. And it's not really for sure that Britain thought about that at all.
Right, that wasn't necessarily on their top of the list.
Right, but there was a lot of noise, people saying they would, or stirring up fear that they're going to not only tax you more, they're also going to, with those taxes, send over their religious diplomat, basically, and they're going to make you believe a certain way. And so there was just a lot of fear stirred up that was...
especially for dissenters. Those like that had already pulled away from that church.
It was like false news, basically. And we thought we invented
fake news.
Fake news, yes, fake news. We thought we invented that here with the internet, but fake news has been around a long time.
Well, and I just double checked. There's still a vestige of this. I'll just read what it says. The Supreme Governor of the Church of England is the head of the Church of England, a position which is vested in the British monarch. So it's still, there's still an explicit connection.
In Britain. Oh, yeah.
Church of England and the Queen, which is completely foreign to us.
That's why we call it Church of England. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So, the colonists weren't too keen on that. But the thing that I learned that made me nuts is that it wasn't just that. There was this, because we all come from someplace, so they left Britain, they left Catholic Europe to come to the States and have some vestige of free religion. But there was this surprising to me anti-Catholic, anti-Popes sentiment in the colonies that caused them to look with suspicion at Britain. And this was apparently a pretty big piece of it. So Britain isn't Catholic, hadn't been for 75 years. And yet there was this huge fear that Britain was somehow going to impose Catholicism. So again, fake news, right? Mm-hmm. Impose Catholicism on the States. And there are several reasons for that. So one of the first people to whip this up was George Whitefield during the Great Awakening at the end, in his last trip really to the States. He used language from the Reformation, which really then was not that long, mm-hmm. Before that. Anti-Catholic, anti-Pope language, and instilling fear in the colonists that you need to keep your eyes out, that you don't be, that you don't come under the thumb of the Pope. Well, there's that. So he does that, he leaves, and then a little bit later, there's what we call the French and Indian War, the Seven Years' War, and mm-hmm. that was Britain defending the colonists against the French, essentially the French encroachment mm-hmm. on the colonies and on the American West. And it's easy, I think, to see that there was this really imposing threat of Catholicism, because it's the North, you have Quebec and French Canada, mm-hmm. and then the Catholic mission presence down the Ohio River, onto the Mississippi River and into Louisiana, and you have Spanish Florida, and you essentially have the colonists all surrounded by Catholicism, and it would be a pretty easy thing to whip mm-hmm. some fear up about the Pope and about Catholicism.
It's pretty easy to make a quick conspiracy about that and get people, motivate people with fear.
And they did. So this is the other thing that made me really think twice. They didn't have the internet, of course. Right?
That's what made you think twice.
That's relatively new. Yeah. And they didn't even have TV. And they didn't even have radio. So where did people get word out?
Mm.
There were a few, print shops that would print tracts and pamphlets.
Franklin. Yeah.
But the people that had the microphones, which they weren't microphones either, but the people that had the ear of others were pastors.
Mm.
And so it was the fear of Catholicism was so substantial that preachers were telling their congregants that if Britain had their way, they'd establish a Catholic church in America, and that that was going to happen. And it was the preachers who were preaching this anti-Catholic, and then consequently, or oddly, the odd connection, anti-Britain message that people were getting whipped into a frenzy about. And then you have this Seven Years' War come to an end, and Britain prevails, thankfully. We'd all be speaking, this podcast would be in French probably, But anyway, so we'll just say Britain wins. And what happens next, though, is pretty substantial, because that it ended in 1763, and kind of the next shoe to drop was in 1764, what was called the Stamp Act. And they taxed stamps for the purpose of funding the mm-hmm. war that they had just waged. Mm-hmm. So there's a few important things here with regard to the establishment of churches. They feared the establishment of Catholicism, and they were strongly anti-Catholic, and they were saved by the Anglicans, you might say, and were strongly anti-Anglican. And then then things happen. And by the time of the Revolution, so you've got this strong anti-British sentiment, strong anti-Catholic sentiment, but by February of 1778, so we're 15 years later, so mm-hmm. The Americans and the French signed the Treaty of Friendship and Commerce, committing France to securing the independence of the United States. Only 15 years earlier, at the end of the Seven Years' War, the Americans had seen France as one of the chief political agents of the Antichrist, and now the French were their indispensable allies. And so there is this whipsaw on Catholicism and the establishment of churches that seems quite pragmatic. The fact mm-hmm. that French could bail us out was really helpful. And it'd be fine if it was just political alliances.
Right.
But the fact that just 15 years earlier we were at war with France, and the reason was that they were Catholic, and now we're making...
And to use the Catholicism as a means of stoking fear for the purpose of the revolution, and then as soon as yes. it's pragmatically necessary... Well, we really like to be friends with the French.
Yes. Yes.
I'm really glad that we don't ever make pragmatic changes in opinion like that anymore. I'm glad we've progressed out of that.
Good. Good. Yes, we've come a long ways, haven't we? And so the other thing that happened right along here was that during all these conversations about Catholicism, Anglicanism, and the disestablishment of the churches, was the fact that the clergymen who were patriots, so these are pastors, again, who have mm-hmm. the opportunity to speak week after week, mm-hmm. made almost indistinguishable arguments for religious liberty mm-hmm. and political liberty.
We read one of those sermons last time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And but you couldn't tell... Are they talking about freedom to pursue your relationship with God according to your conscience, religious liberty, or political liberty from taxation? And the arguments for liberty in both ways sounded the same. Again, so you've got these parallel tracks, mm-hmm. and American Christians then are almost unable to hear a difference mm-hmm. between what's supposedly Christian and what's supposedly political. And so whatever we have going on now, where we can't really discern, is it overstep? Is it overreach by the government to make us wear masks or make people get vaccinated? Or what is actually going on, and should we rebel? And all these questions, these are the same questions they had then. And they mm-hmm. were mixed up from the beginning.
Yep.
I just started, 2020, well, not 2020. I guess didn't start 2020, mask free. But then as soon as that all happened, I really had a hard time saying, what's my Christian responsibility here? Mm-hmm. Is it to rebel? Is it to go along? Is it to submit? Is it to... What is it? What is it? And the reality is American Christians have been having that struggle for a couple hundred years. Mm-hmm. And
it's our birthright.
That's a great way to say it, actually. In fact, because we wouldn't, the states wouldn't have been born if there wasn't that confusion, I don't think. And so...
Well, and conflating religious liberty with just general liberty, and even that individual autonomy, you can't tell me what to do, which is inherent in Americanism. Is there such thing as an Americanism? Yeah, probably.
You just made it.
I just made it up, and I think it works. I'm hearing that happen all the time with the vaccine conversation. It's, well, I'm a Christian, therefore the thing that I desire to do automatically has a religious liberty piece associated with it. That's not how that works. But there's an easy conflation because I just assume these are connected. Liberty here, liberty there. I'm a religious person, ergo I have liberty to do what I desire to do.
And they've always been connected. That's the weird thing about our country, is this conversation has been mixed up from the beginning. In fact, one pastor reached a crescendo of his sermon and said, the cause of liberty is the cause of God. Okay. What? You know, what does that actually mean? I mean, is this, and is political liberty, he didn't even say what kind of liberty, but right. Is it indispensable? Even is religious liberty indispensable to Christianity? That's a different question. No. But this is, that is really the place that, we run into Christianity impacting the revolution in a big, big way. I suppose this would be a good place to talk a little bit about the Great Awakening, because the Great Awakening essentially set the table on this for this kind of religious talk in politics. And there were some who, I don't know how much listeners know or remember about the Great Awakening, but one of the characteristics that is quite astounding still to me every time I read accounts is the frenzy or the mania of these ecstatic experiences that people had all throughout New England during the Great Awakening. There were people who were foaming at the mouth and barking like dogs and falling, fainting and shaking and dancing. And it was wild. And I mean, Jonathan Edwards' Religious Affections was written to help to try and discern how much of this weird stuff is okay and how much of the weird stuff is false.
Is this the work of the spirit? Is this not?
Yeah. And I've read that a long time ago but didn't think about what this meant to politics. But as people were thinking about this, this was the context. We all come from somewhere. The colonists were coming from the Great Awakening. And, one writer blamed the trouble on the dangerous spirit of religious frenzy, a mania he attributed to evangelicals, because there is an enthusiasm in politics like that which religious notions inspire. And so what he's claiming then is, in some respect, is that the engine underneath the frenzy in politics is religious. And again, I'm not talking about really anything that God might have done or anything that would... any of the great outcomes of the Great Awakening with universities or whatever. I'm just saying that the enthusiasm or mania or frenzy that they experienced there translated then into energizing the political atmosphere.
And there's a lot of energy is not quite the right word, emotive energy, emotional happenings in something like the Great Awakening, and then if you, like a George Whitefield, explicitly attach some type of fear there to be concerned about what's going on in the polis, what's going on in the colonies, you can divert that energy very easily, and that's still the problem.
Yeah,
you can go there. There's something powerful about being in a church service. There's something powerful about gathering to hear the gospel, the good news proclaimed, and then if you subtly or not so subtly go, hey, let's attach all the outcomes to this, to going to vote some way or do something or do some political action, you can divert all that energy. And that, again, it's still rhyming. We're still doing that.
Right. Yeah, the rhyming is, I think, notable here. One of the things that Thomas Kidd said, he said, no wonder then that the greatest orators and writers of the Revolution, including Patrick Henry and Thomas Paine, employed biblical and evangelical rhetoric to make their case. Mm. Such rhetoric was the language of the people. That's a heritage from the Great Awakening.
Mm-hmm.
Without evangelicalism's resources for criticizing political power and rousing popular sentiment, the Patriots would never have commanded the allegiance of so many Americans.
Mm.
Which is super interesting, that this religious revival or awakening that I would hope Christians appreciate and would want to see happen again was the thing that set the table for the revolution.
Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and rate us. If you find what we are doing helpful, a review obviously goes a long way. It gets us to other people. It helps with the algorithms. Share it with a friend. Send them a text. Post it on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, whatever. If you have questions, send them to podcast@newlifenw.com. And if you want us to say your name when we ask that question, then put that there as well. We haven't been asking for that, so we didn't even know if we could. And with that, we look forward to the next conversation. Three, two.
I just got a guy. Be ready. I hate you again. You gave me only 3 seconds to do it.